Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
My wonderful audience. It's just always a great thing to know that every Wednesday I get to talk with someone of my own choice on the radio, and to bring that person to your computer, to your ears, and to know that the folks listening are pioneers on the cutting edge, people who care, people who are engaged, people who are concerned. It's a great pleasure. And I want to tell you two things before I begin with my guest, but let me see if she's here. Paula, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Peter. Oh, and
you sound good and clear, too, on your cell phone. That's wonderful.
Good.
Well, before I start with somebody who may be familiar to you from my show and from the wider world, two things are going on in my life right now that are very interesting. First, you know that not very long ago, in a malpractice suit involving a suicide due to Paxil, where I testified that akathisia from the Paxil caused the suicide, in Pennsylvania, in federal court, in the Middle District of Pennsylvania, conservative area, Scranton, Pennsylvania, got an $11.9 million verdict. It shows a change in the views of judges, a change in the views of juries, which means a change in the view of the public. And right now, going down in Florida, going on in Florida, where I just recently testified for a day, is an electroshock suit, and we should have a verdict within a week, and I'll let you know about that. It might be sad and dismaying to get a negative verdict. It may be a very powerful and positive verdict. And in the last couple of days, I've put up on my website something I've been working on for a long time, on and off, and it's a tardive dyskinesia resources center. This is up on my website now. Has about 150 scientific articles on it. It's intended for anybody interested in the subject, whether you wonder if a family member has TD, wonder if you have TD, whether you're a researcher who's very sophisticated in the field, whether you're a clinician, whether you're a potential medical expert. I love the competition. We need more people being medical experts in this field. So if you're moving in that direction, this is a tremendous starting point for you as a potential medical expert to learn about tardive dyskinesia. And it's on the website. You'll see it right up top on the right, where I list my recent highlights. And we also, it's a new website. We just redid it completely a few weeks ago, and it's got a good search mechanism, so you can find it. And I cover every subject, or at least many of the subjects associated with tardive dyskinesia, tardive akathisia, tardive dystonia. We talk about masking. I talk about brain injury, dementia, and tardive psychosis come from the antipsychotic drugs. Got a full list of antipsychotic drugs. This is a long work project that I've developed doing my books, papers, and my legal work, and now there it is for you, for your books, papers, legal work, general education. My guest today is Paula Kaplan. Paula is someone you may have heard on my show before, because I had her on in September and October a year ago. But in those days, for those two shows, it was a, a somewhat different Paula Kaplan, another aspect of this brilliant and creative human being. Oh. And the aspect you saw then was the more traditional CV, you know, research psychologist, activist, social justice and human rights advocate, and you know, educated at Harvard, went to Harvard College at Radcliffe. I guess it was at Radcliffe in those days. And she has had a lot of university posts. She's gotten all kinds of awards, some in the women's studies area. But this is the other side of Paula Kaplan. It relates more in a way to her interest perhaps in the Voices of Diversity project at Harvard that she's been involved in. But it's Paula Kaplan, the award-winning playwright, screenwriter, actor, director. And she's going to talk in the beginning, well, at some point, about her new play, and I want to lay that right out for you now. She's got a new play called Shades. I'm not sure how new, but it's on Off-Broadway right now, and it's won two Best New Play Awards. It's at the Cherry Lane Studio in Greenwich Village. It starts on November 9, and it's a drama that's very relevant to all of our interests. She says it's got a lot of humor, and it's been described as Eugene O'Neill meets All in the Family. She'll tell you about that. Grapples with loss and trauma and dark and difficult secrets. And what I love the most, trying to maintain a loving connections with people very different from themselves. What a task to do all of that in a play. And we're going to be talking about that today with Paula Joan Kaplan. Kaplan spelled C-A-P-L-A-N. Hi, Paula. Welcome back.
Hi, Peter. I'm so glad to be back with you. And thank you for all your important ongoing work. My gosh, you're just amazing. You seem to have endless energy. And you're always at the forefront of what needs to be done. It's really, I do think you're right. We should have you cloned because we need more like you to be expert witnesses and to keep speaking the truth. It's just, it's so rare. It's still too rare.
Well, thank you very much for that. And of course, what you've been doing all along has been very rare, very special, very pioneering, very cutting edge. And by the way, I have to say this at the beginning. I actually won a very minor playwright award at the Source Theater 30 or 40 years ago. I wrote a play and submitted it, and it won the award for new playwright. And I've got two novels that were published in the 70s. So we share that too.
What's it called?
I don't even remember what the play was called.
If we Google it, maybe we can find it.
No, I don't think you can find the play. Never got past the stage reading as a part of the, but I got to see it read on a stage and I got an award. I don't think it's even on my CV.
well, you should add it.
And that's all I have to say on that subject. So now I give it over to you to talk about your theater work.
Oh, well, thank you. And you know, what I'm going to talk about is very much related to the whole matter of psychiatric diagnosis and how bad it is, how misleading it is. And so I just posted something on Facebook. We have a Facebook page for the play. It's called Shades the Play, as all one word. Shades is capitalized and then Z is capitalized and Play is capitalized. And I said, are you as tired as I am of seeing plays and films and TV shows and novels in which the characters are described as bipolar or borderline or having generalized anxiety disorder, as though that tells some important in-depth information about them.
And yeah, narcissistic, that's another one.
Narcissistic, that's right. That's right. That's right. And ADD, of course. So I've loved theater since I was a child, and I did some acting and then started writing plays and doing some directing and stuff. And what I find so frustrating about this is that I think it impoverishes our understanding of human beings. And I do want to relate this to my more traditional experience, which is that, as you know, Peter, and as some of your listeners know, I served on two committees of the DSM-IV. Alan Francis had asked me to be on those two committees. I served on them for 2 years until I resigned. And so there we were. I was supposed to be a consultant while they were producing the fourth edition of the Manual of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And I learned in that capacity how wrong I had been to believe their advertising, which went like this. Psychiatric diagnosis is scientific, and if you get your label, it will help you feel better, and there's no harm involved. There's no risk involved in getting a psychiatric label. So I learned all those three things were completely untrue, and I started speaking to them, to Alan Francis and his colleagues about this, and I said, you know, don't you want to come clean about the fact that this isn't science, and the decisions you make are not based on good research. They're sometimes based on distortions of bad research, or distortions or ignoring or lying about good research if it doesn't fit with what you want. And people are getting hurt. Their lives are being destroyed. They're being deprived of their human rights. And it all starts with getting a label that identifies them as supposedly different from the rest of us and inferior to the rest of us, and it's used against them in a myriad of ways, everything from depriving them of custody of a child to the right to make decisions about their legal and medical affairs, to locking them up or forcing them to be drugged or to get electroshock against their will, and just, oh, it's just so impoverishing. There's that word again. If you say somebody is mentally ill, then the therapists who are supposed to help them tend to have a very narrow view of what might be helpful. So it's either drugs or therapy, or drugs and therapy, or lock them up and give them drugs and therapy, or let them out but force them to be in therapy or take drugs. And even if they're telling you it's not helping or it's harming. So I, having been immersed in all of that since 1985, when I saw that, oh, by the way, I resigned from those committees because they wouldn't be honest about the limitations and the risks of psychiatric diagnosis. They wouldn't be straightforward, and they refused to make any kinds of reasonable changes. So I got off those two committees, and I've been trying to do public education and educate professionals about this information for decades now. So while I've been doing that, of course, psychiatric diagnoses have become increasingly popular. You see how effective I am. And
who knows? You may have slowed them down. But let me tell folks that if you go back on my website and look up the radio page, you can actually search for Paula's shows where she talks about these issues. And Paula has a great sense of humor and great insight. But just take a moment and talk about how you proposed alternative diagnoses to these guys.
Okay. All right. I was going around trying to tell people the truth about psychiatric labels. And one of the things I said was, look, they tend to treat women as mentally ill more than men. So, for example, that Robert Spitzer, who was head of DSM-3 and 3R, he and a buddy on a fishing trip made up the category of premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Now, they didn't propose any equivalent for men, even though it has been documented that men go through cyclic mood changes. And, of course, men on the average tend to be more aggressive and even violent than women, but they didn't want to call that a mental illness, just women. So I would go along and I would talk about this, and I would say, and they don't have John Wayne syndrome or testosterone-based aggressive disorder. And people would laugh. Well, one day I was giving a talk like that, and this brilliant feminist sociologist in Toronto named Margaret Eichler came up to me afterward, and she said, let's do it. And I said, what? And she said, let's create John Wayne syndrome, you know, just like they do in the DSM with a list of what are the criteria for it and all of that stuff. So she came over to my house one night, and after dinner, we created a category that we called DDPD, Delusional Dominating Personality Disorder. And we said, certainly it's not the case that all men suffer from it, and some women even suffer from it. And many of the heads of major corporations, even of countries, suffer from it. And then, you know, we listed the criteria. And I'll just give you one example. That one of the criteria was that they people who have this disorder suffer from one or more of the following delusions: that they are entitled to the services of one woman in particular, or women in general, or both of the above. So we had a long list of criteria, and it was modeled, you know, with tongue-in-cheek on the DSM categories. And so we finished, and we were laughing about this. And then Margaret said, okay, now we submit it. And I said, submit it where? And she said, for the DSM-4. And I said, oh, Margaret, you know,
of course.
Don't be silly. They're never going to put that in. And she said, no, they won't. But she said, but we saved the correspondence. And I got chills up my spine. And sure enough, that's what we did. And it's all documented in my book, They Say You're Crazy, How the World's Most Powerful Psychiatrist Decides Who's Normal. And then, actually, when I started writing plays, and I want to come back to how I started doing that in a minute, but the first play that I ever wrote is called Call Me Crazy. And it's a comedy drama with music, and it's all about psychiatric diagnosis. And when we do the play, I always have to put a note in the program saying every fact, every event in this play is true, especially the ones you'll think I must have made up. Because, you know, when I just tell people the truth about what goes on with the creating and the selling of the diagnostic categories, people think that I must be exaggerating, I must be joking, and sometimes they just laugh because it's so awful that you can't do anything but laugh, and so extreme. So we did submit it, and then these really strange things happened. This is all documented in the book. So for one, as one example, we submitted it, and it went to the committee, the work group on personality disorders, of course. And, oh, I'm blanking on the name of the man who was head of that group. He's at McLean. And so we sent it to him and sent it to Alan Francis, who was the overall head of DSM-4. And I got back two letters, one from each of them. And we submitted it, you know, straight face. We said we'd like this to be considered for inclusion in the DSM-4. And we said that many people who suffer from delusional dominating personality disorder are not happy, are not well adjusted, and so this is a cause of discomfort and pain, often to themselves and certainly to the people around them who live and work with them. And this is a real problem, right? And certainly it is. Anyway, we submitted it, and John Gunderson, that was the man, the name of the personality disorders work group chair. So I got a letter from John Gunderson and a letter from Alan Francis. And John Gunderson said, thank you for submitting this. He said, unfortunately, it arrived too late for us to discuss it at our meeting. And Alan Francis's letter, which came right around the same time, said, thank you for submitting this. He said that he wanted to know, how serious was I about this category? And I wrote back and said, very, because I wanted to see what they would do with it. And around the same time, I was hearing from Alan Francis that he was hopeful that, as I had urged, self-defeating personality disorder, which was disproportionately used to describe women, women who didn't get promotions, women who were battered, you know, it was being blamed on them. All these awful things happened to them because they are mentally ill with self-defeating personality disorder. Alan said to me that in the deliberations of the committee overseeing that one, that he was pretty certain it wasn't going to go in. And at the same time, I was getting a letter from the head of that committee saying that they were going to change a pronoun or a little word here and there. It was clear that it was going to go ahead and go in. And so some of these things were just so ridiculous. And you could see that they were so arrogant that they didn't feel they had to be consistent with each other. They could just say whatever they wanted to say, and of course, hoping that I would just be quiet and go away. But delusional dominating personality disorder, it's really interesting because when I started speaking about that in lectures I would give, I would start to read some of the characteristics, and it's a description of a person who has been deeply affected by the extreme of traditional male socialization. Who really has been socialized to believe they're better than other people and certainly better than women and that other people should wait on them and that they don't need to work cooperatively. They can work competitively and aggressively and that that's the way to solve problems. And so I would start reading the criteria, and I would read the first few criteria and people would listen. And then I would read the next few, and people would start laughing. And then by the time I got to the last third or so of the criteria, people were sitting up straight in their seats and going, "I know people like this." So it had some good, you know, value for consciousness raising, I guess, and it was good for a laugh. So I want to go back.
It's great theater too. Maybe it'll be a show someday.
Yeah, right. It's not in Call Me Crazy. I should put it in Call Me Crazy. That's a good. We could add another song.
It could actually be practically a whole thing, you know, a whole show.
Well, yes, right. Good. So you know, a lot of people have on TV have watched this show Homeland, and it's been one of the most popular shows, and it's gotten a lot of awards. And Claire Danes plays the lead in this. And she works for the CIA. She's very high up in the CIA. And from the very beginning, in all the press releases about this show, it's been said straight out, Carrie is bipolar. Okay, so I started watching this show, and I loved the first few seasons because they were so interesting and so compelling, and the drama was so great, and it was written in a very interesting way. But, of course, at the same time that I was enjoying that, I was watching for, now, what is it that they are having her portray that is supposedly the bipolar aspects of her? Well, there are a couple of things. One is that you, and, of course, they say this always happens when Carrie goes off her meds. So they're really, I wonder if they're funded by Big Pharma or something, or they're just, you know, misled. But in any case, when she's supposedly off her medication, there are two things that you see about her that you don't see at the other times. One is they're trying to solve some sort of mystery. They're trying to find the villain. They're trying to figure out what happened. And you see Carrie with pieces of Post-it notes, thousands of Post-it notes that she's putting up all over her wall and rearranging them, and she's watching videos, and she'll rewind them, and she'll go back, and she'll look at bits of them over and over again. Okay, now, you could say, oh, well, that's the bipolar side of her, or you could say what she's dealing with is matters of life and death and international intrigue and terrorism, and she's being incredibly thorough and hardworking and driven. Now, why do we have to say, oh, see, that's her bipolar side? And the other aspect of her behavior that supposedly happens when she's off her medication is that she will be intensely sexual in a way that male characters are allowed to be without being called bipolar. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that's really upsetting to me. So I was talking about this some months ago with a cousin of mine, Eden Harmon Bernardi, an acting teacher in Hollywood. And she said, I want you to come and speak to my actors about this. She's the best acting teacher I ever knew. She unfortunately died a few months ago, but she was just a remarkable acting teacher. And so she got some of her students together, and what we talked about was actors are increasingly confronting this kind of problem. You're told, okay, you got an audition, and it's for a character who's borderline, or a character who has major depressive disorder, or PTSD, or ADHD. And so what I did was we wanted to talk about what do you do as an actor when you're given this kind of audition. And first I wanted to convey to them some of what I had learned about psychiatric diagnosis, because of course most of them, if not all of them, well, a lot of them of course have been given diagnoses themselves. And of course most or all of them came into that class believing in the truth and the usefulness of psychiatric labeling. And so I thought, well, they're actors. I know what I'll do. So I took monologues from my play, Call Me Crazy. And so instead of lecturing them about this, I had them perform the monologues. And each one was about someone who was just going through a difficult time in life and got diagnosed as mentally ill as a result, and the terrible things that happened to them as a result of getting that label. Well, they got it so fast. They got the point so fast. And then they said, okay, well, basically you've convinced us that psychiatric diagnosis isn't scientific and isn't helpful and can be very harmful. But now what do we do as actors when we get an audition for somebody who's described with a label? And so I talked to them about how, well, first you try to, you look at the script or the part of the script that you're going to audition with, and you try to understand what do you think the playwright wanted to convey about this character by using this, I think, objectionable shorthand of a psychiatric label. And so you go about it that way. So is it just that the person is very distracted? And if so, think about what might be distracting them, what's going on underneath this distractibility, or if they're very anxious, or if they're very, if they're described as having major depressive disorder, are they feeling depression, as David Jacobs and David Cohen wrote in this brilliant paper of theirs, depression is used to apply to just about everything except feeling good. And so I talked to them about trying to think more specifically. And by the way, I think this applies to people who aren't actors. Instead of saying, I'm depressed, if you leave it at that, it's hard to get anywhere. But if you say to yourself, well, if I weren't going to use the word depressed, what word would I use? You can get somewhere. Am I sad? Am I lonely? Am I disappointed? Am I feeling helpless? Am I feeling hopeless? Am I feeling despondent? And the more specific you can be, whether you're a person who's experiencing this or an actor who is supposed to be experiencing it, the more helpful it is in giving you clues about where you can go, what's going to make a difference. And many years ago, when I was teaching at the University of Toronto, I had a student named Nikki Girard, and she wrote a brilliant paper, and she called it Guilt as a Terminal Word. And what she meant by a terminal word was she said, you know, she was a clinician, and she said, if a patient comes into therapy, I'm sorry, I'm in an office and the phone is ringing and I don't know how to stop it here.
I'm not actually hearing it.
Oh, okay. She said, if, you know, somebody comes to therapy and they're saying, I just feel so guilty. She said, where do you go with guilt? You know, where did Woody Allen go talking about guilt? He's been in therapy for how many decades and it hasn't helped him very much, right? So she said, usually when people use the word guilt, they're really talking about something else. And it's usually either shame or fear. Now, if you say to them, if you weren't going to use the word guilt to describe what you're feeling, what word or words would you use? Well, if they say fear, then that gives you somewhere to go. What is it you look at? What is it you're afraid of? Is it a realistic fear? Are there ways to diminish the danger of what you're afraid of? What can you do to get away from that dangerous situation if it is dangerous? Or does looking realistically at whether the fear is about something that really could hurt you, isn't that helpful? If what you're feeling is shame, then again, it gives you some place to go that the word guilt doesn't get you as far. So shame implies that you're failing to meet some standard. Well, once you know that, then you can think about, now, what standard is it? And is it a standard I respect? Is it somebody else's standard that I've just taken on and that I don't really agree with? Shame also implies that you are failing to meet a standard in the eyes of someone else. And you can think about, well, who is it that I'm ashamed to have know this about me? And if it's my third grade teacher, gee, that doesn't really matter anymore. Well, that's a relief. So these terminal words, I talked to the actors about, I said depression, anxiety, and guilt are great terminal words. So if you, with anxiety, when people say they're anxious, usually what they mean is they're afraid. And again, fear is something that you can look at, and it makes it easier to figure out something you can do about it. So I had a great time with those actors, and then some of them wrote to me afterward and said, "Okay, I've got an audition for this now. What do you think? What do you think about that?" And I love that intersection of theater with real life. So, and that's why I started writing plays in the first place, because I had been a psychologist for about 20 years, and I was finding that too few people in the traditional mental health system would connect with people in all of their humanity and complexity and mystery and wonderfulness, with the exception of you, Peter, and a few others. And so I had always loved theater, and I started writing plays as a way to reconnect with all of that. And it's been a real joy. So this play, Shades, I have to tell you, the most amazing thing happened was that there's an organization in New York City called Pen and Brush, and it's a really respected, venerable institution. Eleanor Roosevelt was a member, and Pearl Buck. And they decided to start having a new plays contest, and this play won the first of those contests. And yes, it has been described, as you said, as Eugene O'Neill meets All in the Family. The play is called Shades, and it's called that partly because there are two people who are mentioned a lot in the play, but who have died before the play starts. And in Shakespearean, in Elizabethan English, shade is the word for ghost. And so they're not ghosts like who appear on stage, but their presence is very strong in the play, even though they are not characters portrayed by actors. And then, as one of the people in the play says, it's not all black and white. There are shades of gray. These are people who, there are four characters, three of them are members of a Jewish white family, and one of them is a black woman. That woman and the other woman in the play and one of the men are all baby boomers. And three of the four people, the two men and the black woman, are military veterans. The father was in World War II. His son was in Vietnam and volunteered to go to Vietnam. And the black woman was a clerk typist in Vietnam who got very seriously injured by a grenade. And the woman in the family is the daughter. And she was an anti-war protester during Vietnam. So both because of their different experiences with war, their different political views, their differences because two of them were socialized the way men are socialized and two, the way women are socialized. They have a lot of differences in their experiences, in their attitudes, in their politics. And the and race and racism come into the play because June, the black woman, has, of course, been a target of racism, but has very positive sense of her racial ethnic identity. But there are other parts of the play that are about racism in various ways. The racism within the U.S. military, even while they were fighting against people from another race, the fact that the woman, the white woman in the play, has recently lost her husband, who was a Vietnam vet and who also was Japanese American and born in the internment camps in which our government put Japanese Americans during World War II. So all of these factors are dealt with in the play, matters of life and death. But there's an enormous amount of humor in it. And so it's really interesting because after what I've just described about the people and people, each of the people in the play has a painful secret, and but they all care about each other. They love each other. They want to stay connected with each other. And so a lot of the play is about how do you deal with these personality differences and differences in your history and differences in your experience and differences, big differences in your politics, with people that you care about and without having these differences drive you apart? How do you create connection and love, and how do you maintain it? And, of course, a very useful way to do that is through the use of humor. So when this play had its first production, which was in Los Angeles, it was really interesting to see how people laugh all through the play, off and on. There's a lot of humor. So the play, the first performance is going to be in New York on November 9th, and then it's going to have opening night on the 17th of November and run until the 17th of December. And I would love for people to come. I'm going to be at a lot of the performances. I want to tell you who are doing some of the talkbacks in a minute after some of the performances. And if those people want more information, they can go. This is going to be at the wonderful Cherry Lane Theater in its studio. So if you go to this website, you can get tickets and more information, and I'll give you a discount code to get tickets in a minute. The link, the website is Cherry Lane Theater, and theater is spelled with an R-E at the end, cherrylanetheater.org, and you'll look for this play, Shades, in the studio theater there. And the discount code to use is, as all one word, Half Shades, as in half price, and the play Shades. So use the discount Half Shades. And let me tell you briefly about the people doing the talkbacks. So these are going to be brief discussions that the invited speakers will kick off the discussion, and then anybody can speak after that. And it will be after some of the performances. So on November 12th, after the performance, which starts at 7 p.m., Dr. Phyllis Chesler, who, as you know, Peter,
oh my
is
goodness.
right? She's a pioneering feminist psychologist, and certainly has written a lot about how women are treated, how women are socialized, and then how they're treated if they're well socialized, and
you know,
if they're not.
Paula, she is a dear old friend of mine, whom I used to have a lot of communication with, but not in decades now. How is she?
Mm-hmm. She's okay. She's amazing. You know, she has written maybe as many books as you have. I don't know.
She wrote one that had a huge influence on me and on my book, Toxic Psychiatry, as I recall, called Women
and
Madness.
Yes, that was her first book, and it was it was brilliant. It was groundbreaking. And yeah, and that was about how women who said that came out in the early 70s, women who didn't want to do the housework would get sent away to a mental hospital. What was wrong with them that didn't want to do the housework, you know? And she also showed that
the way patients are treated on a ward was a model for really the abuse of women.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And this was, nobody was really talking about that at that time. And yeah, and every time she's written a book, it's been about some other huge topic. She wrote one called Mothers on Trial, The Battle for Children in Custody. And that was about mothers losing custody of their children, even when they were absolutely terrific mothers. And often because, I've seen this too, and I've done some expert witness work in this area. When a mother has reason to believe that her child is being sexually abused by the father and has tried to get help for the child and, has spoken up about it, well, when these cases go to court, there are studies showing that about two-thirds of the time, the mother loses custody to the abuser because of the way that psychiatry and psychology are brought in the following way. Oh, this father would never do that. Therefore, this mother must be mentally ill, and then she's given one of two or three very commonly used diagnoses in these cases. And so they take the child away from her because she's considered mentally ill, because instead of her motive being to try to protect the child, it is totally distorted into she just wants to separate the child from the father and turn the child against the father. So obviously she's sick, she's vicious, and therefore we should give custody to the father. So the abusive father often gets custody of the child. So every time Phyllis writes another book, it's something groundbreaking. Sure, she wrote An American Bride in Kabul because when she was first married, she married a man from Afghanistan, and she went to live there and saw firsthand how women are treated in that country. And it's a fascinating read. It's a very personal story. So she's doing the November 12th talk back. And then on the 13th, we're having a special, a full day of events. Anybody can come, but free admission for military service members and veterans and their families. And what we're doing on Sunday, the 13th of November at 2 o'clock, there's a performance of the play Shades. There's another one at 7 that night. And in between the two, around 4:15, we're going to do a screening of my documentary called Is Anybody Listening?, which is about the importance of not saying that being upset by being at war or by being raped in the military is a mental illness. We've got to stop saying it's a mental illness, it's PTSD. We have to say, no, it's human to be upset by those kinds of experiences. So we're going to do the screening. And right after the screening, the talk back is going to be led by two people. One is Eric Tucker. Eric Tucker is himself a Navy veteran. He is also about the hottest director in New York City, theater director. His theater is called Bedlam, and he was named Director of the Year a couple of years ago by the Wall Street Journal. And then Dr. Yvette Branson, who's with the VA in New York, but is very non-pathologizing. She works with vets in the most humane way on their real-life problems and without pathologizing them. And then just a few more talkback people. On the 15th of November, this one just got confirmed, Samuel Shem. Now, Samuel Shem is the pen name of Steve Bergman. Steve Bergman used to be a psychiatrist. And then as Samuel Shem, he wrote two books that you would love if you haven't read them, and so would all of your listeners.
I've read at least one of them, but decades ago again. He goes back to the Phyllis Chesler years of my work.
Yes. So House of God was about his medical internship. And then Mount Misery is a thinly veiled novel about his psychiatric residency at McLean Hospital. And guess what? Publishers Weekly just came out with a list of the 10 best satires of all time. And Samuel Shem's book, House of God, was named number 2. And you know what was number 1? Don Quixote.
Oh, my God.
Really good coming. Now Samuel Shem, as Steve Bergman, and his wife, Jan Suri, who's a feminist psychologist, they're both feminists, have written a book called We Have to Talk. And this is based on, and this is why he's doing the talk back for this play. This is based on their decades of work with everybody from school children to older people about relationships between women and men. What makes them work? What society does that interferes, that gets in the way in various ways. So he's going to be doing the November 15th talk back. The November 18th talk, we got three more. The November 18th one is by Majora Carter. Majora Carter is a black woman who is a dynamo. She is a pioneer of work on what she calls environmental racism, which is that in the poorer black neighborhoods, the environment tends not to be as well looked after by the powers that be as in white neighborhoods or wealthier neighborhoods. And so she's done a lot of work on racism, and she's just a lovely person and a wonderful speaker and a real activist. And then on the 19th of November, after the performance, Deborah Sweet is speaking. Deborah Sweet is the director of an organization called World Can't Wait. And they are an organization that calls out governments for doing things that involve committing violence in various ways and at various levels. She's very much a peace activist. And then the last one that's scheduled so far is going to be on December 1st. And let me just, there's going to be three people leading the talk back. And let me just give you a little bit of context. In the play, the white woman character is a nurse, and she meets the black woman who's in a wheelchair because she's in town and she goes to substitute for one of this of the woman's usual nurses, and so their friendship develops, and that's women's friendships is something that I've been very interested in a long time. The first book I wrote was called Between Women: Lowering the Barriers, and it was about women overcoming society's attempt to set us up against each other, and how wonderful and fulfilling our friendships can be. So a big part of the play is about the developing friendship between Val and June. So the three talkback leaders after the December 1st performance are Barbara Glickstein. Barbara is a nurse, and she's also an activist for nurses and does a lot about media and health, and she has a radio show. And then Marcia Rock and Patricia Lee Stotter are veterans advocates. So, you know, one of the two women characters is a nurse, one is a veteran. So Marcia and Patty are veterans advocates, and they are the winners of a New York Emmy for a film they made called Service, When Women Come Marching Home. So I hope people who are listening and live in or near New York or can get to New York will come and see the show. And again, the website for tickets is Cherry Lane Theater with an R-E on the end, theater.org, and use the code and you'll get half price. And the discount code in all capital letters is half shades, H-A-L-F shades, as all one word.
And folks, we are talking with Paula Kaplan, C-A-P-L-A-N. You're just a marvelous human being, Paula.
Peter. Oh, that's so sweet.
You just are. It would be a wonder to be inside your head and experiencing life from all the exciting and interesting viewpoints as an artist, a psychologist, a human rights activist.
Yeah.
Have you thought about doing a biography?
Of whom?
You! Autobiography.
Oh, of me? Oh, I don't think anybody'd want to read it. I want people to come and see the play. Some of it's autobiographical, actually. You can come and guess which parts of it are autobiographical.
I'll tell you one thing.
The character in the play, who's the World War II veteran, is based on my father, not completely. My late father was born in Hartford, Connecticut, very, very poor, in a multiracial neighborhood, very poor neighborhood, lots of immigrants. He was Jewish, and when he was drafted into World War II, he ended up being captain of an all-black artillery battery. And most of the people in that unit were very poor, very uneducated, because they were from the Deep South, with a couple of exceptions. And that was at a time, and this comes into the play, it's mentioned in the play, that was at a time when the armed forces in the United States were segregated, and it was said that you could not send black soldiers into combat because everybody knew that they were cowards and they'd run from the battlefield. Well, I mean, of course, that was just horribly racist. And what happened was that my father and a biracial sergeant from Philadelphia, who was extremely well-educated and brilliant and a composer, and he ended up teaching history at Temple University after the war, Gene Jones, the two of them taught the men, it was an artillery battery, they taught the men how to use surveying equipment and logarithmic tables and all sorts of really high-level kinds of stuff. And the men did so well on their tests for this that the Army could not justify keeping them out of battle. And I think this is so ironic because, as the character based on my father says in the play, they let them go into combat. You have to prove you're smart enough to deserve to die, right? So they went into combat, and they fought at the Battle of the Bulge, which was a crucial battle in stopping Hitler. And they were surrounded by the Nazis. It was right at Christmas in 1944. They were sure they were going to die. And then Patton's army came in and broke through the lines of the Nazis and saved them. Well, the men in my father's unit won a presidential citation for meritorious service. And after my father died, I met a couple of these men, and I'm in touch with both of them. And we're actually making a film about one of them. Oh. He's going to be 99. His name is Isaac Pope. He lives in Kinston, North Carolina. He's going to be 99 in December. And we're making a film called Isaac Pope, The Spirit of an American Century. Because he's got quite a story. So anyway, so that some of the monologues that the character of the father has in my play Shades are taken verbatim from a videotape that my friend Caroline Kinsborn did of my father talking about his war experiences, and the actor who's playing him, Hal Robinson, who's going to be, I guess I'm not allowed to say it yet, the contract's not signed yet, but he's going to be understudying in New York after my play closes, a really huge star. Hal is just a brilliant actor, and all the actors in the play are just doing a wonderful job. It's very thrilling to sit there in rehearsal. So Ashley Wren Collins is playing Val, the nurse, and Jamie Day O'Connor is playing Don, the Vietnam vet. And Holly Walker, who was on the Larry Wilmore show, she's a fabulous actor too. She's playing June, the woman in the wheelchair who turns out to be a poet.
We've got about a little less than 2 minutes left. Just, you know, it's everything. It's so stimulating hearing you talk. But one of the things that it brought to my mind is, you know, I wrote a little book called Wow, I'm an American. And one of the things I learned writing that book was that George Washington actually integrated the army, and the Revolutionary Army had 10 to 15% African Americans in it. And he did that against the wishes of his fellow slaveholders and fellow Southerners. But, and our armies were integrated. I believe it was Woodrow Wilson who deintegrated the army. And then I think it was Harry Truman who reintegrated it, if my memory holds.
Well, you're right. You're right. Sorry, go ahead.
And, of course, there's just so many wonderful stories about African-American heroism. And I think one of my favorite movies of all time, the original movie that was written about their fighter squadron. What was that movie called? You'll know it.
The Tuskegee Airmen
movie. And,
Yeah.
And that, I think it's had more than one incarnation, but the first one is one of my favorite movies of all time.
It's wonderful to have you on.
It's the quietest I've perhaps ever been on a show. You just have so many interesting things to talk about. And when your show is ongoing, if you can think of more things to talk about in the middle of your show, or maybe toward the end, give us a call. Email me. Again, Paula Kaplan, it's just wonderful to have you on the air.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter. And I hope I'll see some of your listeners at the show. They can reach me through Facebook and let me know they're coming, and I'd love to meet them. Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye, folks.
Bye.
Good to have you listening to me and to Paula Kaplan.